You are listening to the Magnetic Marketing Marketing Secret Gold Members Only Podcast. Today, the topic I want to talk about was the back end, selling things from high ticket, certifications, area exclusive, all that kind of stuff. I know that the course this is kind of synced with is the, what was the name of the course? I'm blanking out right now. Area exclusive, high ticket. Was that a mastermind or event? What was the context of that event when you guys ran it back in the day?
That was a very small group. I don't remember now the dollars, but it was high, maybe 10 G's, maybe 15.
Mm-hmm.
And it was not mass marketed to the list. It was by invitation. People who were in that environment.
Mm-hmm.
The course itself, candidly, it's probably out of date.
I remember listening, I was on a plane flying somewhere. I don't even know, but I remember listening to it. And it was fascinating because obviously you talked about high ticket stuff. But then I think right now, especially in our market, like high ticket is a big topic everyone's talking about. But you were also going into different versions of it, like licensing versus air exclusive versus all different variables of high ticket that I think most people never thought about. In our world, it's like sell a $25,000 thing. And that's kind of all, that's the extent of high ticket in the current world. And I know there's so many more variables and things you can do.
Well, yeah. If you're operating on the not really having a business, but having episodic income events, then that's fine, but there'll be a day where you won't be able to think up the next one.
Mm-hmm.
You know, you put yourself in the position of the Hollywood studio or now Netflix, where every 8 weeks you better have another blockbuster.
Mm-hmm.
And in many cases, there's opportunity to have permanence, ongoing back-end revenue from these big-ticket sales. And people that don't consider that, slow down long enough to consider it, or don't know that it exists, you know, lose out. Ongoing money to maintain the licensed rights, the ability to take those rights away, that sort of thing can be pretty important.
Mm-hmm. Maybe let's start there then, because the difference between just selling a high ticket coaching program versus licensing, maybe let's start with like licensing. How does that model work? What does it look like? How do people leverage their intellectual property and licenses as opposed to just selling a coaching program?
So sometimes we call this coaching plus, where you are, and I'll give you a couple examples, where you are getting some form of coaching, and with it, you are getting the licensed rights to use. Then there's a question of exclusivity or non-exclusivity. You are getting the license rights to use content, tools, technology, all the way up to having leads generated for you, national lead generation, and given to you in a local area. And from parents' standpoint, all of this can be unplugged should you leave coaching. So you take something that has virtually no glue to it. If I have you in a coaching program, you might think the person will stay forever if they're getting value and results, but that's not the case. The majority will drift off over time for a variety of reasons that have nothing to do with the value you are delivering. So you take this thing that really has no glue, and you suddenly make it really, really, really sticky. So like my client, Craig Proctor, with the largest or maybe the second largest coaching company in real estate at different coaching levels, the agent in the coaching program also has licensed rights to Craig Proctor sales content for websites, recorded messages, email campaigns, webinars, listing presentations, et cetera, et cetera. And in most cases, some of that is delivered in media that is vended by or through coaching company like the website. So the day you decide to leave coaching, there's like 20 plugs in the wall that all get unplugged. And you've got to place it all for yourself from scratch or from somewhere else. And not only is there an efficacy issue, meaning is what you're going to replace it with as good as what you've got, but there's a massive business disruption inconvenience issue. So that now makes it sticky. In Marty Ford's coaching business for music school owners, there is this ladder system for the action for the students. Essentially a awards system for the students at each school. It is all done for you, school owner. And you have the license rights to use it, and you have access to the materials you need for it, badges and bands and ribbons and signs. And should you leave coaching, get a cease and desist and all that goes away. Marty also creates competition events at all the schools in coaching and offer to their students. So they'll have a event at the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame in Cleveland or the Elvis Presley Museum in Memphis, and the participating schools in coaching will let their students compete to participate, and some number of them then get to come to the event and perform on stage and be videotaped performing on stage at the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame or at the Elvis Presley Museum. These are things that the individual school owner, as a practical matter, can't do for themselves. And as a matter of convenience and initiative and all of that, they won't do for themselves. So being suddenly disconnected from all of that, not a very appealing thing. So it now makes coaching sticky because of all of these add-ons. And get all the way to the point that the parent who is providing coaching is also providing lead generation and is generating leads or at least supporting lead generation. So I built with Dr. Burleson a program called Excellence in Orthodontics, which provided coaching plus tools plus a certification plus then presence on Excellence in Orthodontics national website, which was advertised in Disney magazine and Family magazine and so forth. So consumer leads even flowed through it. And should you leave coaching, all that gets disconnected. You can, by the way, broaden this idea beyond our businesses. And so people like seeing this, if this winds up in the newsletter, who are not in information marketing at all and own six hardware stores or jewelry stores or own a dental practice or whatever, they can think about level above customer, patient, or client, and they create, and what sticky element can they put in it that will create predictable, if not recurring, ongoing revenue rather than episodic sales revenue.
It's interesting to talk about this. Like Alex Hormozi is one of the guys in the ClickFunnels community, and he helps gym owners grow the companies. And he took, I think initially started as a $2,000 course, and then he just shifted the messaging from like, this is the course to this is licensing. Now instead of like, let me teach you how to do ads, it's like you're licensing the ads I created. It went from a $2,000 to a $36,000 a year program. And it was yearly instead of just buying the course one time, which is interesting.
Yeah, well, he's absolutely right. You know, see, the problem with, one of the problems with pure information, he probably did area exclusive too. The problem with pure information, regardless of how we deliver it, in a book, in a box, or in a coaching program, is truth be told, I can't get paid what it's worth. You can't get paid what it's worth either. There's a wall where you're just asking too much for the person on the other end to process as, gee, this makes sense to spend this amount of money. So from my perspective, Alex's perspective, Craig's perspective, et cetera, the value of the information is seven figures and above used. Certainly six figures and above. But if I ask you for $100,000 for a 6-week course or for a monthly coaching call, some combination thereof of information only, that becomes a very difficult sale to make. Think about a money pyramid, the 1%, 4%, 15%, 80%, and how they think. That's a sale you're probably only going to make to people who are already 1%ers, thereby excluding 99% of the market. If, however, we repackage that so that value is the same, deliverables maybe are enhanced, but fundamentally are the same. But we repackage it in a way that people can understand and assign greater value to it. such as by a licensing agreement or a area exclusive licensing agreement or even membership concept, then $100,000, say over 3 years, $36,000 a year, does not seem nearly as outrageous. And there are contextual comparables, like a franchise, that we can now evoke, right? So I can talk, if I'm selling you a $36,000 a year program for your gym, I can evoke franchisors in your field, and I can evoke the $36,000 Subway or sports clubs or Jimmy John's that you have to buy three of them. You have to own a three pack. And if you're lucky from all three of them combined, you may pull $100,000 and you're going to be dealing with pimply faced kids and food spoiling and et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. So I have comparisons. If I deliver that to you in a book, a box, a coaching program, it's harder to make the same comparison. In the prospect's mind, this does not compute, right? And if you add to it, if you choose to, certain done-for-you elements, then the value justification gets even easier because you figured all this out for yourself, or you just hired a coach or a consultant to teach it to you. Now you got to go get copywriters and graphic designers and web developers, et cetera, to make it usable for you. And that bears costs. In this case, these costs are all inclusive, to whatever degree you make them all inclusive. When you do geographic or by industry or by other means, when you do area exclusive, I'm only guessing, but I'm guessing Alex did. If you do area exclusive, you add a lot of additional value. And its only cost is its limitation on you on how many you can sell.
Mm-hmm.
Because the deliverable itself is the same. But guy in Cedar Rapids, Iowa, who now is the only guy in Cedar Rapids, Iowa, gets to have this and work with you. And he has three competitors in Cedar Rapids, Iowa that he hates. So them not being able to have it now is value to him. But it bore no cost to you. Very exclusive. Geographic area exclusivity it bumps up against franchising, and so there's legal stuff that people have to understand when they do it so they don't cross the line unwittingly into being a franchisor,
mm-hmm.
that you do not want to make. But that is essentially where you wind up. You wind up with a non-franchise franchise.
Mm-hmm. Interesting. So people can do area exclusive. You're selling just an area. Have you seen, or the versions where it's like, instead of just an area, it's also like exclusive to a niche or to an industry or to, you know what I mean?
Yeah.
Other variables like that.
Yep. It's actually fairly common in licensing of content. So I might license, would now, of course, but I might license magnetic marketing for architects to a info marketer or tribe leader dealing with architects.
Mm.
And he would have exclusive rights. might license magnetic marketing for plumbers to someone in that niche, and he would have exclusive rights. And this is fairly common, info marketing. You see it in publishing with book series, where something like the For Dummies series will do, or Gerber's a better example, what Gerber did with eMyth, the eMyth for restaurant owners and the eMyth for dentists, et cetera. Those are all licensing deals.
You know, he licenses it as like one dentist, one person, or do you have multiple in an industry?
Well, you have one. In most cases, it's one, unless it's one tribe leader.
Mm-hmm.
A info marketer to dentists might want the eMyth for Dentists license and co-authorship with Gerber.
Mm-hmm.
Now, licensing to dentists at the consumer level, where let's say you have a book about how to prevent diabetes and cancer with good oral hygiene, would need a better title and get the idea. And you made yourself a celebrity author, you might license a co-authored version of that to thousands of dentists, certainly to hundreds of them. And you might area exclusive that license, or you might not. This is done in the financial advisor community again and again and again. And I've been a part of doing it in the financial advisor community.
How would you price ones like a co-authored book versus a whole industry? Like, how do people price stuff like that traditionally?
So there's a handful of pricing methods. There's the, now I forget the acronym for it, but it's the pull it out of your ass method, which is you just kind of arbitrarily decide what your happy number is, taking into consideration cost of sale, cost of deliverables, if you're placing limits on how many you can sell, limit the back end revenue and so forth, you pick a number. And then you match it against your value argument and you decide whether or not it's saleable or not. And then you test it. In many cases, by the way, people do cowardly price testing, which is okay. Let's use the word timid instead of coward, where you might sell the first five at, let's say, $10,000 plus a back end, and discovered that was easy. You might immediately redo your pricing and start selling at $14,995. And gee, if the next five sold easy, you might start move it to $19,000. And if that's easy, you might move it to $29,000. So that's method number one.
That, by the way, is the method how Alex launched his. He sold the first person on the phone for $8,000. The person said yes. So the second call, he did $10,000. Guy said yes, third call to 12 and got all up to 36,000. And
yeah. So like with racehorses, a really good day is when you sell a horse you wanted to sell, but it's immediately a bad day if the guy said yes to your price. Because you say to yourself, well, shit, that was too easy. And if he thinks that horse is worth $10,000, maybe I'm wrong, and I shouldn't have sold them. Now, if you have to haggle and fight to make the sale, you feel better about it. So I understand Alex's method. A second method that stands alone or gets used in concert is frame of reference, meaning what price point is your target audience familiar with, accustomed to paying in the broad category of what you're doing. So if I'm selling a Coaching Plus licensing program to dentists or to mom and pop restaurant owners or to independent insurance agents, I have three different frames of references. The dentist is the biggest because he's used to buying or leasing expensive equipment that provides a return on investment by what it does. He has an office lease, he has staff, you know, et cetera. The mom and pop restaurant owner, probably the only really expensive thing they got is the walk-in freezer. And so they don't have the same common frame of reference for, let's say, a $25,000 purchase with which to improve the business. The independent insurance agent, his frame of reference is even lower. He maybe pays to go to a seminar once a year. So you consider frame of reference. Next, you consider your return on investment argument to them, which has a lot to do with their transaction size and their customer, client, or patient value. Personally, I've always loved making the just give up your firstborn child argument, meaning what you are paying us is offset by the first new customer, client, or patient you get that you wouldn't have got without us. And that's a transaction size frame of reference. If you're dealing with a business that the transaction size is much too low, then you have to try and make that with a customer value argument. So that's a path pricing, right? You have intangible values. These are harder to make arguments, but they are arguments when you are selling at relatively high price points to consumers instead of to business owners and entrepreneurs. So if I'm selling a high-end weight loss coaching program, I'm a psychologist. First thing I could do is create some scarcity where I'm only going to accept 10 patients at a time in this program or 8 weeks. But I don't have a dollar-to-dollar ROI for that $15,000 sale. So now I have to make the intangible arguments of, you know, what will it be worth to you to finally, permanently be thin? And how long do you expect to live? And by the 15,000, by the 22 years left on your life expectancy, it's so much a year, it's so much a month, it's so much a day, heck, it's almost down to Starbucks money. So I have to get into that kind of argument. Sell an $8,000 hearing aid, you're into this kind of argument. When you're selling $30,000 a dental restoration case, you're into this kind of argument. What's it going to be worth to you to have everything back on the menu for the rest of your life? Be able to bite into an apple without realizing you don't dare, et cetera, et cetera. Some of that has to do with, gee, how long do you plan on living? You can even do that with the pure financial argument. You go back to the original Renegade Millionaire system pitch argument. When it was first sold in print, in the sales letter, and in the first stage presentation, it was sold with the life expectancy argument of, here's the average male life expectancy, here's the average female life expectancy. So see where you are, how many years you have left. And we can divide the price by that number of years, because the value is for the rest of your life. And we can see what your investment is by the year, by the month, by the day. We can also ask the intangible question of, how many of these years you have left do you want to continue having to do business with people you don't like, having to make sales in a manner that you don't like having to make them, having to work harder than you think you should for the money you do make. How many of those years left do you want to live like that? So I invoked it for a pure financial argument. And the price decisions are always all about, what can I make them pay? Number two, what is actually a fair price for the value they will obtain, providing, of course, they use what they're getting?
It's funny, I actually, man, probably a week before FHL, I was looking through all the old things. I found the original Renegade Millionaire sales letter. And now I got to go look for the original stage presentation where you sold it. That's actually, I got to find that now. I'm on a mission.
It was at a super conference, if that helps you. And it was during the Bill years.
Okay.
By the way, they're very close to the same, because the stage presentation came from the sales letter.
Okay. It was at a super conference, not Info Summit.
It was a super conference.
Okay. So cool.
There was a Renegade Millionaire pre-day, and it was sold there. And everybody who bought it there got a Renegade Millionaire shirt to wear now during the super conference. So everybody that didn't have it saw all the people who did. And then we sold it again during the super conference.
Mm-hmm. That's awesome. I love the whole brand, Renegade Millionaire. So cool. So one thing I want to, just for people who maybe in their mind, they're like, I don't have something that I could do this with yet, right? I think about, I mean, Alex is a good example. Alex ran a bunch of gyms and was like, he didn't think like, oh, I should license the stuff I did to grow my, you know, like, how do we get people thinking of like the processes that are unique and they're already developing in whatever their other business is, how it can become an opportunity to offer to other people?
Well, look, the first thing I would say is that from a wealth standpoint, you have to think about three things. You have to think about duplication, multiplication, and leverage. Because getting to any real significant wealth, not tied up in a business or in a house you live in, but I mean, like spendable, investable, personal retirement pension wealth, purely through earned income, is extremely difficult. Not as difficult here as it is in Europe or in other countries, but it's still extremely difficult, principally because it's very hard for people not to let their lifestyle grow with their income, number one. And number two, our tax structure makes it very, very difficult. Now, there are brief periods of time where that changes in our favor and happened in the 60s with John F. Kennedy's extreme tax cuts. It happened in the 80s with Reagan's extreme tax cuts. And it happened very recently with Trump's extreme tax cuts. But otherwise, the rest of the time, our tax structure just is not favorable to you getting to wealth through your earnings, whether from your job, career, or your business, your single business, your law practice, your dental practice, your hardware stores, your restaurant, your e-commerce site, any of it. So this says you have to think about duplication, multiplication, or leverage, right? So duplication is the first and simplest thing to think about, which is I have figured out X. This is the fundamental basic of information marketing. Through study and research, and it can be that alone, or better yet, through study and research and personal experience and successful experience, I have figured out X. So that's Jerry Buchanan. I figured out how to get rid of gophers from my garden and stop them from eating all my vegetables. Or that can be Alex. I figured out how to have a successful gym business. That can be Marty. I figured out how to have a really successful high-income music school, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. Now that I figured this out, how do I want to can it and clone it? How do I want to duplicate it and get money by duplicating it? So the thing most business owners do is they open a second location. They open a third location. They open a fourth location. And from a long-haul equity standpoint, there's certainly an argument for that. And there's a big and complicated argument for that, including buying real estate with the business's money, therefore winding up with a lot of very valuable real estate free and clear. If you look at Marty Fort's music school business, not his coaching business, went from one school to two schools to three schools, and he's managed it in a way he puts in no more time owning three schools than he did owning one. The schools are all buying the real estate underneath them with their income, et cetera, et cetera. So that's one way business owners duplicate. Another way they duplicate is by franchising or by licensing. Is I don't want to run these damn things, right? But I can either take somebody who's already in my business and I can teach them and license them and let them use all my stuff, and let them pay me for that. Or in some cases, I can take people off the street and I can put them in this business and teach them everything and license them to use my stuff. And I'll essentially duplicate myself in every market big enough for there to be one of me. And I'll get a little bit of money from all of these people instead of 100% of the money from another location and another location and another location. You can obviously do both. Multiplication is duplication on steroids. So this tends to get us into coaching plus, mastermind groups, where we are into group delivery rather than one-to-one delivery. So instead of duplicating yourself one clone at a time, we mass clone and we mass deliver. So guy says, I figured this out. I got everything in a box you need in order to run a dance academy at twice the profits of the average dance academy. I've figured this out. I can have $1 million a year financial advisory practice and never do a free evening seminar. And I got all the tools, and I got the webinar, and I figured this out. And I'm going to can it and clone it, but I'm going to clone it by multiplication, not duplication. So now I'm going to say to the entire financial community, here it is. I got it. Only one of you per area can have it. And the race is on. And the first group of 50 is going to start on November 1st. And then there'll be another enrollment period for a group, but I'm not sure how long that'll be. So you want to be in the first group of 50, and all the deliverables are done by group. That's multiplication. Now, before I go on, looping back to the very start of the conversation, in almost all these cases, you want back end, not just front end. You want recurring monthly revenue or annual renewal or biannual renewal or by some formula. You don't want to just get a price. You want a price plus relationship money, theoretically forever, if you can get it. So, you know, that's a big consideration. And then the third thing you have to think about is leverage. So leverage has a lot to do with, in the early stages, not figuring things out and creating things only to be used by you and your single business, because there's only so much of you. You're only going to do so much with your single business. So you go to all the work and all the trouble of perfecting. So, like, we have a Diamond member right now. I won't mention their names, but I think they were on the September Diamond call. I doubt they were on the August Diamond. In any case, they've spent money on copywriters. They have really cracked the code. They have a classic magnetic marketing three-step letter system, now becoming a four-step letter system. produces clients for Medicare supplement insurance. And its backdoor is to financial planning and other financial products. And it works cold, meaning you get a list, mail the letters, income the lead, and the insurance gets sold. So they've gone to all the trouble to perfect this. But using it themselves in their area, where they're licensed to sell insurance, they can only mail it so many times or it'll wear out. And there's a cap. They can only sell so much insurance. The only leverage there is now on the back end with the other financial products. But some method of duplication or multiplication to an equivalent of them, an insurance broker in every area, can generate an enormous amount of money. So it takes that asset and it leverages it up. Then slower, later, your leverage questions all have to do with equity, meaning are you creating anything that, should you want to do so, you can sell? And what kind of individuals or companies buy the thing you're creating? At what multiple of EBITDA or earnings? And what considerations now does that create for you about the business? Want to worry about this? Do you not want to worry about it? Want to very deliberately create it? Often, wealth comes from the leverage of the equity of the company when it is sold. Hard to get the same multiple on an ongoing basis from your own earnings. So that's the last thing you have to think.
Very cool. Okay, one more mini question before we end this one. Just for people who are like the legal side, and this is outside of my brain, maybe it is for you as well, but like the difference between franchises and licensing, like where they need to be careful of, what's the gray area so they can, people can be careful if they decide to go one way or the other.
So I will give you an answer, but with the very important caveat that I'm not an attorney.
I don't like him at all.
And the comments I'm about to make are not a substitute for appropriate legal counsel. Certainly not a substitute for doing your own research, e.gov, etc. And no responsibility or liability accepted. Giving this answer. Broadly speaking, franchising involves multiple factors. And depending on how you do it, you can violate one or some. So if wearing a red hat and a red scarf and red boots and red gloves makes you a franchisor. May not be a franchisor if you wear a red hat and a red boot, but you don't wear a red scarf and you don't wear a red glove. But if you wear 3 out of 4 or 4 out of 4, you're at high risk of being classed a franchisor. So some of the key factors are use of brand. So are they using your brand or are they using all of your stuff but with their business identity? Or are they co-branding? They're using your brand. That's pretty much a red scarf. Next would be the amount of done for them that exists. This also gets you into securities law, which is another ballywick. Broadly, the more you are doing for them, not giving to them for them to use, but doing for them, the closer you get to wearing a red scarf. Third would be, this is big, are you getting a royalty or some other percentage of their revenues or earnings? That is definitely a red scarf. However, if that's the only thing of the red items you wore, there's a lot of coaching programs that involve percentage of a base, where it literally is a percentage of the gains occurring during the term of the coaching. So that's just a red scarf, and there's no red hat, and there's no red gloves, and there's no red boots. It's very hard for that to get classified as a franchise. But if you add the boots and the gloves, you may very well get the thing classified as a franchise. So you have to be careful how you get your back end money. Under the best circumstances, it is fee for service, not percentage of gross or net. And then the area issue, you are selling an exclusive area, meaning you own East Toledo, and here it is drawn on a map, and I'm not going to accept anybody else in East Toledo, and anybody that does drift over the border, we're going to do something about it, unlike our national system for borders, but franchising works, actually is a wall, etc. That's a red scarf. That can get you classified as a franchise. If, however, I carefully say to you, there is area exclusivity in this, meaning you are the only client I'm going to accept in East Toledo. Here's East Toledo on a map. That does not mean that a client in West Toledo might not pursue referrals from his customers in East Toledo, might not even open an office in East Toledo. I can't do anything about that. And I'm not saying that I will. I'm only saying I'm only going to work with and provide this stuff to you in East Toledo. In direct sales language, that's called area of primary responsibility. And that allows me the attractiveness of area exclusivity without crossing the line into actually selling area exclusivity. It is, as you characterized it, now a gray line instead of a dark black line. These are all considerations. Oh, enforcement is a consideration, meaning I say to you, not only are you using the brand, but here's the colors the sign has to be, and here's where the sign has to be on the roof, and here's the uniforms your people have to wear, etc. And I enforce it, and I'll yank your license. You're not compliant. That's a red scarf. That can get me classified as a franchisor. If I make all those recommendations, but I don't enforce it, or we're co-branding and you have a lot of flexibility in this, then that's not a red scarf. And that helps my argument that I am not a franchisor. Want to be a franchisor, by the way, that is another duplication and leverage opportunity. And it is nowhere near as onerous as it was a decade ago. A conversation with a good franchise lawyer. Registration in the States now mimics the registration federally. It can really be legal, if you will, to franchise for about six figures. And it used to be seven.
Kind of the rule of thumb, the more control you want more control, you go franchising. You want less control, stay back there.
Well, franchising is, there is the issue of control. Absolutely right. There is the issue of equity. Thus, a franchise company is easier to sell than a non-franchise. So, like in our world, Dr. Tomczak made the decision from his three successful health source chiropractic practices to become a franchisor, not a licensor.
Mm-hmm.
Conversion franchises sold to chiropractors already in practice. He has created and has the first and only successful franchisor in chiropractic and is building a company that has a lot of equity. Could go public, could be sold.
You've been listening to one of our gold members only podcasts. Make sure you upgrade and become a diamond member and get access to the diamond members only podcast as well. On top of that, you'd also get access to the whole enchilada with all dance courses and so much more. So make sure you upgrade to diamond now by going to diamondupgrade.com.